I've thoroughly enjoyed studying Ruth this week. It's been good for my own soul and my own heart as I've studied a passage from the Old Testament and really wrestled with how does this passage look at Jesus? How do we get to Jesus from here? As we read the Old Testament is written and every word points to Christ. Well, in our particular passage, we ask the question, how does Ruth 2 point to Jesus? And I'd ask you something as we get started. What is something that is steadfast in your life? It does not move. It's always consistent. Well, some may say, the sun. Initiating the song, The Sun Will Come Up Tomorrow. Anybody? Some may say breathing. Some of us breathe more than others. Some may say the pile of dishes in the sink seems pretty consistent to me. Pretty steadfast. But as you think about it, as you walk through the door of your house after work, or today when you return from our worship gathering, what's something that is solid? It doesn't move, and you can build your house on it. Well, hopefully you can say you can build your house on it, because some of our foundations are cracked. But the foundation of your home is something that is steadfast. It's intended to be steadfast. So unless it has a crack in it, it is steadfast. So then, but in a solidly built house, a stead foundation serves to hold everything else up. The foundation, it is steadfast. Our passage today focuses on the steadfast, solid, immovable love of God as he orchestrates every event in the lives of those who take refuge in him. And that's the main idea of Ruth chapter 2. God orchestrates all of life's circumstances to display his steadfast love for those who take refuge in him. And the exhortation is this, for us. So what does that mean for us? Well, let your heart take comfort in the refuge of the steadfast love of the Lord. Now, to bring us up to speed from last week, we ended Ruth chapter 1 with bitterness in our mouths. As two widows returned from Moab without seed for food, grain, and without seed for offspring, lineage. Naomi has returned from the land of Moab, where she was led by her husband Elimelech, which means God is the king. My God is king. And he led his family there looking for food in another place other than where God had provided, in Bethlehem, where he was from. Bethlehem means the house of bread. So he was seeking sustenance in a place where God had not provided it. Seeking sustenance in another land. And so she returns. Naomi has returned at the end of this chapter. Naomi returns from the land of Moab to Bethlehem, again, the house of bread, in Yahweh's land, because only Yahweh can satisfy the deepest needs of our hearts. And the plot thickens in Ruth chapter 2 as we're introduced to the heartthrob of this ancient rom-com. Remember last week, some of you didn't know what the word rom-com means. It means romantic comedy. So this is the original gangster OG of rom-coms in the Bible. Like a drama, the chapter is split into several different acts. And here's the structure of the chapter. And I'll keep it on this for a little bit. And then we'll come back to the main idea. But here's the structure. Boaz enters in verses 1 through 4. So we're kind of introduced to the character. Boaz discovers Ruth in verses 5 through 7, and then Boaz speaks kindly to Ruth in verses 8 through 13, and then Boaz serves lunch to Ruth in 14 through 16. And then Boaz, the Redeemer, is revealed in verses 18 through 22. So now that we have a little more robust knowledge of the chapter, let's read it together. And so if you're in Ruth 2, follow along with me as I read. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to the young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servants who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young woman, the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves and the reapers.' So she came and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, for I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law, since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves. Now do not reproach her. And also pull out from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean. And do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned and was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Beside, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Forgive me, I'm getting over a little bit of a cold. And thanks for your patience with that. So chapter 2 is all about God orchestrating all the events in the lives of all these people to display his steadfast love, a love seen particularly in the character Boaz. All right? And his name means this: in Yahweh is strength, or in him is strength. So Boaz's character is intended to point our attention to Christ, as we'll see more and more clearly as the story unfolds. The meaning of his name plays an important role, because we'll see that God displays his great strength and steadfast love through Boaz as God raises a royal line from a dead man's broken lineage. So let's look at Boaz's entrance. Look back at verse number 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. So at first glance, this verse seems a little bit detached, right? It's kind of just dangling there. So like we ended with like Naomi and Ruth, and Naomi says, basically, God has dealt with me bitterly. And then there's just like almost abrupt, enter Boaz. And it's a little bit random. Here's a random dude inserted into the story. That's the author's way of creating suspense. And then, as I've mentioned, we're introduced to this random dude in verse 1. And little by little, throughout the story, we're going to kind of find out a little bit more about this guy, this person, Boaz. And at the end of the story, it's like the author drops a bomb. This is who Boaz really is. So it starts out by describing him as a relative of Naomi's husband. The original language here actually uses the word know, like we know something. So it's translated relative in most English translations, but the author isn't getting that specific yet. He's basically just introducing, here is someone that Elimelech knew, and he was of his clan. He's saying that Elimelech was a good friend, had a good friend named Boaz. And he'll keep adding to that friendship throughout the whole chapter. Well, he reveals that Boaz and Elimelech were in the same clan. Okay, a little bit more about Boaz. But the author doesn't yet reveal the card that their close relatives, a redeemer, until the end of the chapter. So you don't know that he's a redeemer yet. If I can use the terms of the Jedi, you don't know that he's a redeemer. To look back at verse 1, he's described as a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. So we know that he's in the same clan of Elimelech. So this is further revealing the family relationship of some sort. And he's a worthy man. Now, other places this word is used to describe a warrior, a mighty man of valor. And it uses actually this word to describe the woman in Proverbs 31, the valiant woman. That's the term that's being used here, a mighty man of valor. Now, he's saying that Boaz was a well-respected man of substantial status and wealth. He's introducing him as our knight in shining armor. Look at verse 2. It says this: and Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field, and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Now, the author immediately returns back to Naomi and Ruth, who are poor and destitute. Do you feel like the jolt from Boaz to Naomi? The author is doing that on purpose because he wants us to feel the major distinction going on here between their social economic status. Boaz is this grand, wealthy, strong, well-respected man, and Naomi and Ruth are poor, destitute, common laborers. That's what's going on here. The author paints these ladies, though, as respectable, strong, and hardworking. He doesn't paint them as victims, and they don't see themselves as victims. Strong, sturdy, hardworking, godly ladies. The only way for these ladies to eat, though, was for at least one of them to gather food in the field of a landowner who was faithfully observing God's laws. You see, in Leviticus 19, God made provisions for just this situation when he commanded landowners, wealthy landowners, to be thorough in the, not to be thorough in their gleaning of the fields. So in harvest time, you have these big fields, and what God commands his people, his landowners, don't be so thorough in your harvesting that you leave no food for the poor. So they were, God said, don't glean the corners of the field or the edges of the field. And when grain fell after reaping it, let it lie. And let the people who are poor come and feed themselves from your fields. So that's what's happening here. People like Ruth and Naomi were being fed by the Lord as poor and sojourners. So let's keep looking. Look at verse number 3. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. I want you to notice that little phrase. Does a little phrase kind of jump off the field, the paper at you here? Like, she happened to, right? Wait, isn't this like talking about God's sovereignty and God's providence and God's like orchestrating all the events? And you hear this little phrase, kind of just happened to be in Boaz's field. Do you know anyone who's sarcastic? No. Daniel can't even play the guitar. Sarcasm. Yeah, California is the most conservative state in the union. Sarcasm. If you'd really like to have an extremely healthy meal, go to McDonald's. Very healthy. Right? So those are all, that's all sarcasm. And that's what's going on here. The author is communicating exactly opposite of what he is writing in the words. He's saying it's not just that it happened. God is orchestrating these events. He wants us to know in a humorous way, he's humorously emphasizing that God is orchestrating every detail of Ruth's journey, right down to the specific path she took, to the specific field she ended up at, to pick the specific grain she was eating, and to meet this specific man, Boaz. It just so happened. And he uses a similar statement as he introduces the next verse. Look at verse 4. Verse 4, he says, "And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, 'The Lord be with you.' And they answered, 'The Lord bless you.'" And certain translations kind of pull it out a little bit more, but essentially what he's saying in saying, "And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem," he's saying, and wouldn't you know it? Boaz shows up at the same field. It just so happened that Boaz was there too. The author is emphasizing God is in control of every detail in the lives of these poor ladies and this very wealthy man. So this is very, very important for us to remember. God is in control of every detail in the story of our lives. And one of the ways that I remember this is by journaling. You know, during some of the darkest times of my life, I've gone back and not only read through Scripture, which draws my attention to God's care and sovereignty and steadfast love, but I also read through evidences of that as I look back and read how God led us all the way. One of the most vivid reminders of that for me was how God brought us here to Twin Falls, and I've spoken about it before. But if you want this real like the full story, I'm happy to give it to you. But God was orchestrating details through being laid off from my job with two boys and an 8-month old 8-month pregnant wife. He orchestrated specific conversations with specific pastors in different parts of the country. He orchestrated conversations with groceries in grocery stores and in coffee shops that I had no idea would happen. God was orchestrating every detail along the way. God was displaying his steadfast love to me in the practical, everyday things in my life. Now, when I look back, I can see the sweet hand of God's providence leading and guiding, moving us from Louisville all the way here to Twin Falls, Idaho. I even think about conversations that Joshua and I had that we just so happened to be going to the same camp with our youth groups and began talking about what would God have for us in Idaho. Think back through your story. Where do you see God's hand of providence guiding and directing your footsteps to display his steadfast love? Many of you have spoken with me in detail about how God has orchestrated the details of your lives to display his steadfast love, whether it is to get here through valleys and through mountaintops, through painful times and through happy times. God has led you all the way. He's working and orchestrating every detail of your life to display his steadfast love. Let's keep going. Look at Boaz's first words in verse 4. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." As we learned last week, the first words of a character often serve to define their role in the story. So what do we find that he talks about right away? What are his first words? "The Lord be with you." Boaz's first words make us think about the Garden of Eden, the tabernacle. They make us think about God in the wilderness, in the pillar of fire and the cloud. They make us think about the name of Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us. And the more we read about Boaz, the more we'll see Jesus in this story. For his very first words, as we see Boaz pointing to Jesus and his character, will continue to do that again and again and again throughout this story. We're looking for Emmanuel, God with us. Now, early barley harvest typically ran from March to May, followed by wheat harvest would have gone from May to June. So the harvest process had three steps. I think it's helpful to explain the harvest process in order to kind of fill in some of the gaps of what goes on here in this chapter. The harvest process came in basically three steps. You started with the men who would take sickles and basically knock down all the barley, the standing barley, and knock it down and go throughout the field. And then what they would do is they'd take it and make it in big heaps of barley. And then the second process, the ladies would come through and take those big heaps and organize them into bundles or stalks. They would stick them together and make them ready for transportation for another time at another place. That'll be in chapter 3 where we'll find that process. Then the third step is for the poor and the needy to come through and to glean up what was dropped by those harvesting the grain. And that's what's happened. This threefold process will inform our understanding of Boaz's generosity as we observe where Ruth is placed in the field throughout this chapter. Look back at verse 9. Let's keep going. "Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you?" Now, Boaz speaks directly to Ruth. He's found out a little bit about Ruth from the guy whom he had talked about, the guy who was in front of him. And he says, he describes Ruth as a Moabite or a Moabitess, and he does it twice. He calls her, if you look back in verse number six, he says, she is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. It's like a double dose. Hey, just so you know, this widow is from Moab. And if you don't remember, she's a Moabitess. He really wants to underscore her underprivileged. She shouldn't be here unless you're being kind to her, following God's laws. And so Boaz begins to talk to her in verse number 9. Now he calls her his daughter, my daughter. This is likely intended to communicate both affection and also protection. But it also gives us a window into the age gap between them, as he was likely around the same age as her father-in-law, Elimelech, 20 or more years older than Ruth. So he's likely in his 40s or 50s. And now before you start hating, just remember that Brad Pitt is 59 years old and Tom Cruise is 60. I'm just saying. He continues by urging her to keep coming back to work in the field and assuring her of his protection and provision. She was to drink water as if she was one of his own workers. This wasn't normal. She would have to fend for herself, bring her own water. And so Boaz is showing his true colors as a man of generosity and integrity. He was treating the poor and the needy with dignity and respect, as God's law commanded. Now, blown away by his lavish kindness, Ruth falls down to her face in a posture of deep humility and respect. Look at what she does in verse 10. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" Ruth is using a play on words here. You can't see it in the English translation, but in the original language, she's using like three consonants that would be like boom, boom, boom. Like, oh, she's intending for us to understand something important here. She's highlighting something. She uses three catchy Hebrew words to point out the fact that she, the one who shouldn't be noticed, was noticed by Boaz. She's highlighting her unworth here. I shouldn't be noticed, but you have noticed me. Her question hits at the heart of this culturally awkward moment. By all means, she's a foreigner, a Moabite. One thing, the foreman was sure to make clear. And from her perspective, she was a foreigner who had nothing to offer. Nothing to offer. She was not someone who was worthy of notice. She was a nobody. Not even a lowly servant, according to her words in verse 13. The word Ruth uses here for favor means total, unmerited favor or regard. Does that sound familiar? She had nothing to offer, and yet he lavishes her with total, unmerited favor. And her question is this: why? What's motivating your kindness to me, a foreigner? This is such a powerful question because it reminds us why God gives us grace. Because it reminds us first that God noticed Ruth, even though she had nothing to offer. God saw her. Though she had nothing to offer Boaz, he noticed her and showed her total unmerited favor. The New Testament calls this grace. Friend, God sees you too. Your life does not escape his gaze. He sees every detail of your life and is orchestrating those events. And the book of Ruth reminds us that God doesn't just see us because we have something to offer him. He sees us even when we have nothing to offer him. It reminds us that God doesn't see us because we have something to offer him. He doesn't notice us because of our social status or our ethnicity or our marital status or our theological training or our good works or what denomination we're from or what political affiliation we have. No, Ruth had nothing to offer Boaz, not one thing. Like we have nothing to offer God except our spiritual poverty, our total depravity, our sinfulness. God loves to display his grace and steadfast love to those who take refuge in him. That's it. He doesn't give us grace because we have something to offer him. Mom, God sees every tired moment, every frustrated outburst, every tear, and he still loves you based on what Jesus has done. Single man or woman, God sees every lonely moment on the couch and he loves you in it. His love for you is not based on your marital status. He loves you. Hardworking man or woman, God sees every moment you work, but his steadfast love is not based on your work. It's based on the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross. That's grace. Something that we cannot buy, we cannot earn. God's total unmerited favor is something that is freely given to us as we trust in Jesus and turn from our sin. Church member, even discipleship in the local church doesn't earn us God's favor. Yes, we are all called to it. But God's grace is not earned by how many people we disciple. We must train our hearts not to believe the lie that God's grace is not the lie that God's grace is something that we can earn. It is not something we can earn before or after salvation. God's grace is freely given to those who are weak and feeble enough to lean on him. Those who take refuge in him. So look at Boaz's answer in verse number 9. Let's keep going. Verse number 9. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged you? He begins by referencing what he's heard about her. But there's more to it than that. Boaz's statement here, if you keep reading, I might have gotten mixed up here in my verses here. Let me find it. Yes, verse number 11, excuse me. But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before." So he begins by referencing what he heard about her. But there's more to it than just she abandoned her family and her land And one of the commentators mentioned that he believes this is the most significant literary allusion in the whole book. This statement in verse number 11. Puzzling? What would make this statement important? Well, it's because it echoes God's first words to Abraham in Genesis 12. God calls Abraham to leave his father and mother and native land in search of a city whose builder and maker is God. But this time, it's a Moabite woman, a widow, who reenacts Abraham's journey of faith. She leaves her land and family to return to her new home. Remember that word return from last chapter in chapter 1? She returns to her new home, the house of bread, where the strong one provides, protects, and blesses her with land and offspring. The offspring of a king. So while Abraham became the father of the nation of Israel, Ruth will become a founding mother of the monarchy, King David, and ultimately the Messiah. What powerful words you have here in what Boaz says. And he continues, Yahweh, he uses the covenant name of God in his relationship with Israel. He says, Yahweh, the Lord, repay you a full reward. So he's using, as a businessman, he's using business language here, like a business transaction. But wait a second. Doesn't that paint a picture different than what he just said? A picture of Yahweh as a transactional God? Well, we can't detach Boaz's words here from the context. Look how he continues. Under whose wings you have come to take refuge. The picture here is of a little vulnerable birdie. Little chicks. Finding refuge, protection, and nourishment under the wings of the big mother hen. Boaz is specifically referencing Ruth's repentance from her own land, her own gods, and seeking refuge in Yahweh, in his land, and his provisions. This word, he's referencing her repentance and faith. She has found refuge under God's care and protection, and God will take care of her. Now listen to her response in verse 13. There's that word favor again. She says, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. So it means unmerited favor, as we've discussed. And at the end, she once again highlights that she is undeserving of his favor by referring to herself as lower than his lowest servant. And notice Boaz's grace only results in her humility. And that's what grace is intended to produce in us as Christians. The more we grow in our understanding of God's lavish grace, the more humility it should produce in us. She says, you have comforted me and spoken kindly. And this word kindly is not the word hesed that we're familiar with from chapter 1. It's actually the word that means heart. He spoke comforting words to her heart. He has lavished her with blessings, though she was lower than his lowliest servant. Then we're taken to the next scene. Boaz invites Ruth to eat at his own table. Now, look at the next verse, verse 14. And at the mealtime, Boaz said to her, come and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. You see pictures of the Lord's table here as Boaz invites her to eat bread and drink wine. This is exactly what happens to us when Christ rescues and redeems us. We are invited, come on, come sit at my table, eat my bread and drink my wine. We get a small taste of this feast every time we celebrate the Lord's Supper, as we will later today, proclaiming the gospel until he comes again. We are spiritually destitute and poor like Ruth. Sinners, redeemed, and yet feasting at the king's table. She eats at his table and is satisfied to the point where she gets a to-go box. Can I get a to-go box? I'd like to take this home to my mother-in-law. She feasts to full satisfaction at Boaz's table. This is once again a picture of Jesus. One we see when Jesus feeds the 5,000 and 12 baskets are left over. We see it once again in Colossians when we see that Jesus fills us up, completes us. He satisfies the cravings of our longing hearts. He fills us up to satisfaction when we take refuge under his wings. Under what other wings are you seeking refuge? Then Boaz instructs his men to let her not only follow behind them as we keep going in the reaping process, but actually glean among them. This is lavish again. He's moving her from step three to step two. Hey, the ladies gathering into stalks, go gather with them. I want you to go up there. And the word actually he uses in verse 16 for glean is usually translated to take booty, as in like pillaging a village or like a city. To take booty like a pirate takes his treasure. That's the idea here. You can almost see him chuckling like Ebenezer Scrooge at the end of the story when he tells his farmhands to let her take as much booty as she wants. Hey! Tell her to go up there and get as much as she wants. There's like a giddiness about it. At the close of the day, verse 17 indicates that Ruth threshes her grain stalks right there at the harvest field and then gathers her loot to be carried back to Naomi. When she measures her loot, she has something between 29 and 50 pounds of grain to carry home. It's a lot, not an amount an average gleaner would have collected in a day. So she heads home to share her loot with Naomi, which takes us to our final scene in the chapter. Look at verse 18. Verse 18. She took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw that she had what she had gleaned. Full stop. Period. Notice the author is very clear to announce that Naomi saw what she had gleaned. It's one complete thought. Naomi saw it. Period. Full stop. Ruth doesn't even talk. And then she pulls out more. The thought of Naomi, the thought there is that Naomi is like astounded. What? It's like a husband after a wife's shopping spree. Except like not the question of like, how are we going to pay for that? Hey, what? Where did you get all this stuff? Look at his question. Look at her question. Where? You can't help. It's like two ladies just like giddy about it. Where did you get all that stuff? Where have you been gleaning today? Blessed is the man, here's that word again, who took notice of you. Ruth's answer to Naomi. The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. The author kind of drags it out. Like, so it's like, where did you work? Who did you work with? Well, you know, the man. His name is, I worked with him today. His name is, Mom, did you see all the grain I got today and how much food I had? Ruth, tell me, who did you work with today? Boaz. I worked with Boaz. His name is Boaz. Yahweh has strength. She exclaims a blessing on Boaz by proclaiming that Yahweh has not forsaken the living of the dead. She is building to the punchline of the chapter as she once again references God's hesed, covenant, loyalty, love, steadfast, immovable love. It's the love that we read about this morning, for God's love, his steadfast love, endures forever. It's a foundation. It's an anchor. Every grain. God, it's like she says, God is so faithful. Ruth, can't you see? God has been working in every detail, the deaths of our husbands, every painful step on the journey home from Moab, every grain of barley, every conversation. God has orchestrated it all to show his steadfast love to us and to our dead husbands. What a wonderful God we have, Ruth. Naomi further clarifies what she means, and she says, Boaz is a close relative of ours, and here's like the punchline, the A-bomb, the mic drop. He's one of our redeemers. Boom! Naomi is referencing the kinsman redeemer, the one tasked by God with the responsibility of protecting and providing for the poor family members, as well as preserving the family line. It just so happened she worked in his field, and he was there. I'll speak more in detail about this next week, because that's how Ruth 3 is all about, this kinsman redeemer conversation. But it's the big reveal. This is the big reveal at the end of the chapter. It's like the big reveal at the end of Extreme Makeover Home Edition. Whoa! That's shocking! It's designed for us to have like, whoa, I totally didn't see that coming. Naomi is overwhelmed as she begins to see the sovereign hand of God that has been busy orchestrating every detail of her journey to display his steadfast, immovable love. Now, I'd encourage you, the last words of Naomi in this chapter are intended to draw our attention back to her words at the end of chapter 1. Look at 121. Just peek back there with me. Verse 20, actually. Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought evil or calamity upon me? Yahweh's steadfast love is beginning to be seen in the story of Ruth with the entrance of Boaz. And it's transforming Naomi from bitter Mara back to good or pleasant, sweet Mara. It is good, is yet another, as she says here at the end, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with this young woman, lest in another field you be assaulted. She says, it is good, is yet another subtle reference to God's presence of God and God's protection and provision that has turned the bitter taste of this in this widow, these widows' mouths, into the sweet taste of God's steadfast love. So as we wrap up our time today, Ruth 2 reminds us of a couple take-home truths. First, God sees the unnoticed, the foreigner, and the vulnerable, and he desires to lavish us with his grace as we take refuge in him. This is why it is important for us as a church to begin looking for ways to reach into the refugee and foster care communities, and to pray that God uses us to display his steadfast love to those in need. Because we are also similar to Ruth. We are spiritually destitute until Jesus makes us whole. Second, God is orchestrating every event in your life too, even the tough ones. When you walk through the door of your house today after this gathering, or other times in your life, maybe after work, Remember the solid, immovable, steadfast love of God. That is the foundation to every event in your life. As you drive by foundations in your neighborhood, be reminded that the steadfast love of God serves as your foundation in every area of your life. Third, God's steadfast love is not dependent on your social status. Because we are born sinners, we have nothing to offer God except our sinfulness. Our money does not impress God. Our ethnicity does not impress God. Our political affiliations do not impress God. Our discipleship does not impress God. For even that is His work of grace through us. Church, let your heart take comfort in the steadfast love of our awesome God.